This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. About 1 in 8 women in the United States will develop invasive breast cancer during their lifetime, and approximately 40,000 women will die from breast cancer this year. Joining us from the University of Cincinnati Cancer Institute Comprehensive Breast Cancer Center to discuss breast cancer causes, treatments, and current research are Dr. Amy Argus, a radiologist and assistant professor at the UC College of Medicine, Sarah Kanapke, clinical manager and licensed genetic counselor in the Division of Human Genetics at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Dr. Jamie Lewis, surgical oncologist and UC College of Medicine assistant professor. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And thanks, everybody, for being here this afternoon.
Sure. Thank you.
Jamie, tell us, breast cancer, it seems to be a disease that impacts a lot of women and their families. And in my own case, my mother had it. My sister-in-law had it. I've had numerous friends who've had it. It's just really amazing. This is a pervasive disease in so many ways, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And like you pointed out, the majority of people will have someone either that they know or commonly that they're related to who has a history of breast cancer. Because again, to reiterate, 1 in 8 women in the U.S. will be diagnosed with breast cancer during her lifetime. So that means 230,000 women annually are diagnosed with invasive breast cancer, and approximately another 60,000 annually are diagnosed with breast cancer. So it is quite common. And in addition to those women, a very small number of men will also be diagnosed with breast cancer. It's the second leading diagnosis of cancer in the U.S., second only to skin cancers. And it's unfortunately also the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the U.S.
Amy, the American Cancer Society estimates, as Jamie was pointing out, that there will be more than 232,000 cases of invasive breast cancer diagnosed in women this year. And that doesn't even include the tens of thousands of cases of non-invasive breast cancer. So what's the difference between these two types of cancer?
Well, the difference between invasive and non-invasive cancer, basically, some cancers can start inside the milk ducts in the breast. And when the tumor cells are confined within the milk duct, within the basement membrane of the milk duct, that's considered non-invasive or in situ. It's called ductal carcinoma in situ. So that's non-invasive cancer. But what can happen, those non-invasive cancers can continue to grow and break out of the milk duct, break out of the lining of the duct, and become what we call an invasive cancer, invading into the breast tissue. Once that happens, an invasive cancer can then continue to grow and then can then shed tumor cells into the lymphatics of the breast, which can then spread to the lymph nodes, usually under the arm, and then spread elsewhere in the body or metastasize. So non-invasive cancers, when they're maintained within the milk duct, have no ability to spread typically. But if left untreated, will eventually progress to an invasive cancer.
Jamie, what are the signs of breast cancer?
So the signs of breast cancer are variable. Most often, there are actually no external symptoms because at this point, luckily, the majority of breast cancers are diagnosed on mammogram, where there's an abnormality on imaging. If someone does have a cancer that's potentially a little bit more advanced, they may have a lump. They may feel that lump either in their breast or possibly under their arm. They could have skin changes. They could have skin thickening. They could have redness or maybe dimpling or changes in their nipple. And less commonly, they could have pain or symptoms elsewhere in the body.
The skin changes that you were talking about, is that what's known as inflammatory skin breast cancer?
So some skin changes are associated with inflammatory breast cancer. Inflammatory breast cancer is a special diagnosis of a much more advanced type of breast cancer that involves skin changes of the majority of the breast, where the skin actually, it looks kind of like the peel of an orange, and it's often very red. But there can be skin changes associated with a smaller cancer if the cancer is located close to the skin, and that doesn't necessarily make it an inflammatory breast cancer.
Amy, just because a woman discovers a lump in their breast, that doesn't necessarily mean it's cancer, but it also doesn't mean it's something that she should ignore, right?
Correct. Yes. Many lumps in the breast are actually not cancer. A very common cause of a breast lump, particularly in a premenopausal woman, would be a cyst, which is it's kind of like the glands in the breast fill with fluid and cause a little water balloon in the breast. And those are perfectly harmless, but they often cause lumps. Also, there are all kinds of benign or non-cancerous masses that can actually form in the breast as part of something we call fibrocystic changes in the breast. They're basically normal things that happen related to hormonal influences on the breast, but they often cause lumps that can be felt in the breast, but they're not cancer. So, you know, one important thing that women should think about or realize when they feel a lump in their breast, they should definitely have it evaluated by their doctor for their doctor to feel the lump and decide if it is indeed potentially something suspicious. And then usually imaging would need to be done to further evaluate the lump. It's very difficult to differentiate a cancerous from a non-cancerous lump based just on the way it feels. So many times we need to do imaging, usually with mammography initially, but sometimes things don't always show up on a mammogram. And so whenever there's a lump that's felt in the breast, if the mammogram does not show an abnormality to explain it, then we need to do another test that's called an ultrasound. And an ultrasound basically uses sound waves to look in the breast tissue. And that can usually differentiate the difference between a fluid-filled cyst or a solid mass that could potentially represent a cancer. That being said, many solid masses still are not cancer. So sometimes we need to do a biopsy of a mass to determine whether it's actually cancerous or one of these benign fibrocystic type masses that can commonly occur in the breast.
But the best course of action is to get it checked out.
Yes, definitely get it checked out. One thing let me say that I think is very important, you don't want to only have a screening mammogram if you have a lump in your breast that you feel that you're concerned about, because as I said, not all things show up on a mammogram. So you would definitely want to come for a test that's called a diagnostic mammogram and most times an ultrasound so that something's not missed.
Jamie, is it possible for a benign cyst in the breast to become cancerous?
So typically not a benign cyst. If someone's been evaluated and they have what's called a very simple cyst, those don't become breast cancers. They don't necessarily need to be removed unless someone is symptomatic. There can be type of cysts that are called complex cysts that could have a small risk of an associated cancer. But most cysts are not otherwise problematic.
Is there an average age for women when they develop breast cancer? Is it 20s, 40s, 50s? Or
the average age of breast cancer diagnosis in the U.S. is 61. It is very uncommon for someone to develop breast cancer before the age of 20. But beyond the age of 20, the incidence slowly increases and then much more significantly around the age of 50. And then there's no age at which anyone is safe either. You can continue to be diagnosed with breast cancer throughout your lifetime.
Sarah, we've been talking about the physical aspects of breast cancer, but there's a lot of psychological aspects that go into it as well. And in your line of work, you see that aspects that affect not only the woman, but their partner as well.
Certainly. And I deal mostly with individuals who have a personal or family history and may have some risk factors that make us think that they might be more likely to have a hereditary component to their cancer diagnosis or their risk for breast cancer. And absolutely, that is not just a medical situation, but certainly an emotional one as well for many families, given what they've seen other relatives go through and maybe have lost their life to this condition. So it definitely is something that causes a lot of worry for many individuals. And so it's important to feel armed with appropriate information about your risk and what sort of screening tools and, you know, risk reducing strategies there may be for you in particular.
And so when it comes to dealing with cancer, knowledge is power, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Amy, is there a relationship between breast cancer and other forms of cancer? For example, am I more likely to develop another form of cancer if I have breast cancer? Do we fully understand the relationships?
Well, that depends. If you have a non-hereditary form of breast cancer, just a random breast cancer, which is what most breast cancers are, usually non-hereditary, there's not necessarily a link to any other types of cancer as far as we know. However, there are hereditary genetic syndromes that run in families that are associated with a very high risk of breast cancer as well as risk of other types of cancers. And there are actually many of them that have different risks for different cancers, which is something that Sarah can probably speak to more than I.
Yes, absolutely. So if we recognize that an individual or family has a hereditary risk factor for breast cancer, those genes can be, as Dr. Argus mentioned, can be associated with other risks. So a lot of people are aware of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations that can cause increased risk for breast cancer, and those can also be associated with other cancer risks. So most notably ovarian cancer. So if you didn't know that you were a BRCA carrier, then you may also be at risk for ovarian cancer unknowingly. So again, as you mentioned, knowledge is power. Understanding if you have a genetic risk, what also may go along with that, what other sorts of risk factors you may have and need to be informed and have some options to cope with.
If a family member had breast cancer, Sarah, does this necessarily mean that you're going to get breast cancer, or does it just mean you're more likely to get breast cancer?
And this is, again, a discrepancy between those individuals who have sporadic breast cancer versus those that have hereditary or familial breast cancer. So certainly having a family history puts you at increased risk. Usually to a modest extent, but if you have a hereditary component to your breast cancer in the family, then those people that inherited that risk factor can have a greatly increased risk of developing breast and other cancers. So again, sort of that risk assessment, talking with your healthcare providers, if appropriate, also talking with a genetic specialist can help you sort of differentiate which of those categories you fall into.
Jamie, do we fully understand what causes breast cancer and all the factors that go into it?
Absolutely not. There are a myriad of factors that are associated with breast cancer, from things that people absolutely can't change, such as for women, the age of their first period, when they go through menopause, the family history that they were born into. We know that diet affects risk of breast cancer, although we can't say exactly how or what foods we should avoid or which foods specifically we should eat. We know that alcohol has a significant impact on both risk for breast cancer as well as recurrence after a diagnosis. Exercise, whether you are someone who works at night, your risk of breast cancer can be increased. So we don't know exactly all of the causes, but we know that there are a lot of influences on risk.
We will continue our conversation about breast cancer after the break, and you can join the discussion by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The American Cancer Society says the chance that breast cancer will be responsible for a woman's death is about 1 in 36. Now, the good news is that death rates from breast cancer have been declining since about 1989. Still, breast cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in women, exceeded only by lung cancer. My guest this afternoon as we talk about treatments and research on breast cancer are Dr. Amy Argus, a radiologist and assistant professor at the UC College of Medicine, Sarah Kanapke, clinical manager and licensed genetic counselor in the Division of Human Genetics at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Dr. Jamie Lewis, surgical oncologist and UC College of Medicine assistant professor. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And tell me about the role that each of you plays in fighting breast cancer. Amy, in your case, your work is in radiology, so I guess in a sense you're on the front lines, aren't you?
Yes, yeah, that's true. I'm often the one that finds the cancer initially. So we use screening mammography for most women, for women age 40 and over, to look for signs of cancer so that we can find cancers when they're small or early before they can be felt as a lump by the woman or her physician. So I am typically the one who may find an abnormality on a screening mammogram, ask a woman to come back for more imaging, and potentially end up doing a biopsy to diagnose a cancer. Also, you know, maybe evaluate a woman who has found a lump and then needs imaging and ultimately end up diagnosing the cancer. And then once we've found the cancer, then we send them to Jamie, to Dr. Lewis and to Sarah for treatment and, you know, genetic evaluation sometimes.
So I often see them next after they've gotten a phone call back that says that their biopsy was positive or that they need further evaluation. And I often sit down with patients and tell them not just about the surgery that they may need, but potentially about other therapies, chemotherapy, endocrine therapy, whether or not they may need radiation. And we talk about if they're going to need surgery, if they're going to need reconstruction, and I really help them to coordinate their care. And again, I may also at that visit or a later visit direct them Sarah's way if they may have a familial risk for their breast cancer.
And then we usually see those individuals who have certain risk factors, either before a diagnosis or after a diagnosis of breast cancer. We treat families who may be at risk of other, we meet with other families who may be at risk of other cancers as well. But for those individuals who might be diagnosed at a particularly young age, or for those who have a family history of breast or other cancers, they sometimes come to us and often in the beginning of their care, because they might actually want to use the genetic workup and information in decision making about what to do next with regard to their surgical intervention, certainly with regard to what to tell their family members. But it does actually have the genetic piece sometimes has direct impact on their care for that cancer as well.
So Amy, based on what I'm hearing, it really does take a team effort to fight breast cancer or any cancer for that matter, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yes, it definitely does. And we all work very closely together.
Jamie, breast cancer rates have been declining since 1989. Incident rates have been dropping, I think, since the early 2000s. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
What are these declines attributed to?
So especially right after 2000, some of the declines were attributed to the Women's Health Initiative studies, which came out and showed that there was an increased occurrence of breast cancer amongst women who took hormone replacement therapy. And subsequent to that, a lot of women did discontinue hormone replacement therapy. And we think that that led to some decline. And it seems to be that the incidence now is stabilizing.
But early detection still, that's one of the major keys, isn't it? Because your survival rate goes up as the disease is caught earlier.
Absolutely. So thanks to both early detection as well as improvements in treatment over the last few decades, survival rates have significantly improved. For a lot of women now, breast cancer is not a death sentence. For a lot of women, it's almost like diabetes. It's almost like a chronic disease. There are some women who will die of breast cancer, but like you said, 1 in 8 women are diagnosed, and thankfully only 1 in 36 will pass away from the disease. So a lot of breast cancers are very treatable at this point.
How often should a woman do a self-exam?
We do recommend that women do self-exams, usually starting around the age of 20 if they're of average risk, and that they do it on a monthly basis. For women who are still having their periods, usually doing them about a week or so after, when the tissue is easier to examine, is recommended, and as regular as possible. Now, there are no There are no really good studies that actually show an improvement in survival when you do self-breast exams. But for a lot of women, having an awareness of their breast tissue may allow them to identify lesions earlier than we may see them on imaging or that a physician may find them. While they're anecdotal, I do have patients who have found 5-millimeter breast masses on their own exams, which I couldn't feel.
I don't know how in the world you could do that.
It's quite impressive.
Now, how often should a woman get a mammogram? What age should they start doing that at? Amy?
Most women at average risk should begin mammograms at age 40 and have an annual mammogram. That's the recommendation for most of our major medical societies stick with that recommendation of annual mammograms beginning at age 40. Now, some women who have a family history may need to start earlier. So the recommendation for women with a family history would be that they should begin their mammograms 10 years earlier than their first-degree relative was diagnosed with a breast cancer, but not before age 30, typically. So if someone's mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at 38, then she would start at 30, you know, or if it was at 42, she would start at 32. That being said, also, if there's a familial risk or if there's a potential genetic risk in the family or a known genetic mutation, we may actually begin even early as 25 if there's a known, say, a BRCA gene mutation, which people have probably heard of as the one that Angelina Jolie was found to have. Those women we begin screening at age 25 with mammograms and another test called a breast MRI, which is a much more sensitive test. It's basically the best test we have to find early breast cancers. But it's an expensive test, so we don't use it on everyone at average risk. We recommend it for women at a very high risk, such as those with a very strong family history or those known to have a genetic mutation, or even if they haven't been tested, if there's a genetic mutation that's known in their family, we would screen them as if they have one. So again, for the average risk woman, we start with mammograms at age 40. For the high risk women, we start earlier and may also add MRIs.
I'd be interested in knowing what each of you think about this. There was a study that came out earlier this year that cast some doubt on the value of mammograms. It found the death rates from breast cancer and from all causes were the same in women who got mammograms and those who did not. So, Jamie, I mean, do you agree with that, or what do you think of that particular study?
Actually, I think Amy and I were here and talked about that study a few months ago. There were some potential downsides to that study, which I'll let Amy maybe point out in further detail. There have been a number of studies that have come out. Some have been in support of screening, and some have definitely shown that the value may not be quite what we think it is. But we think that there were significant concerns about that study that we still feel screening beginning at the age of 40 is most appropriate for the majority of patients.
Yeah, so my thoughts on the topic, if you care to hear. The study you're referring to is performed in Canada, I think. It was this Canadian trial. And they actually performed the mammograms in, it was like 1980 to 1985 or something. It was an old study. And at the time, even at when the study began, there were great doubts about it because the technology they were using was not good even for that time, and people had reviewed the technology and the mammogram images and said they were not adequate. So they had poor technology. The positioning that they used was not the same as what we use now and actually didn't include all of the breast tissue. It was a different view that they used that missed a lot of breast tissue. And there was a lot of questions about non-randomization of the patients put in. So it wasn't surprising that what they published recently was the 25-year follow-up, that they did not find any difference in mortality rates among women screened or not screened. However, the study had been completely disregarded by most of the medical community back in 1980s and 1990s as not useful. And I don't think it's even usually used in any of the models that we use to predict how good, you know, screening is at saving mortality. So, but there have been many other studies who, you know, which have shown a mortality benefit. Usually the mortality benefit, meaning the decrease in deaths from breast cancer. Most studies looking at screening mammography find on average about a 40% decrease in mortality. It varies between different types of studies. And in fact, an interesting thing I read actually very recently is a publication. I'm blanking on what journal it was published in, but it was published recently. I think the journal, the National Cancer Institute, they looked at mammograms in Canada now. So they did their mammograms in the 2000s, I think, and they actually found a 40% improvement in mortality with women being screened in Canada, and it included about 85% of the Canadian population. So that I kind of got upset that study got so much press saying that mammograms aren't saving lives when there's so much other good data showing that they are. So we basically just disregarded that whole study.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jamie, we're talking about possible risk factors in causing breast cancer. Is there any connection to the number of children that a woman has, when they first got pregnant, whether they've ever had a miscarriage or an abortion? And any of those play a role?
So definitely the number of children that a woman has, as well as especially the first, the age when her first child is born. So the younger a woman is, the more protective it seems to be. So especially if you have your first child under the age of 30, that does decrease your, cancer risk. If you have your first child between about the ages of 30 and 35, there may not be an associated decrease with that first pregnancy. And actually, older ages at the age of first childbirth may increase your risk of developing a future breast cancer. Women also that have children at an early age and then have multiple births seem to further reduce their risk of breast cancer. The association with miscarriages and abortions isn't as well defined. That's not clearly understood. The one that I think is the most interesting is that women who have a history of preeclampsia, where they develop severe hypertension during pregnancy, both they, as well as if they have a daughter, both of them are at significantly decreased risks of breast cancer, which is very odd. And from what I can tell, no one quite understands it. But I think it's one of the most interesting factors associated with breast cancer risk that I've seen.
And hopefully the hypertension goes away at some point as well.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't want to be stuck with that.
Maybe they're at higher risk for heart disease, but they're at lower risk for breast cancer.
But also important, I was just going to point out that a lot of women have no identified risk factors for breast cancer. And so I think it's important to point out to the listeners, especially that, you know, whether or not you tick any of those boxes or have any or don't have those risk factors, everyone's at risk.
I think that's true, Sarah, because I think the statistic I read was that 85% of breast cancers occur in women with no family history of the disease. So it's something that that women should take very seriously.
Now, I think that's quite true. I have patients who come in and to some extent they feel guilty because they got breast cancer. Maybe they missed a mammogram and they're blaming it on that. And so we have to remind them that mammograms don't prevent breast cancer, or they feel like if they would have changed their diet or done something that they could have prevented it. But for most women, it's just the fact that you're female and that you have breast tissue that's there and it can develop cancer.
Amy, I think this is a question for you. Dr. Sawyer called. He wondered if health organizations could reduce the cost of MRI since they seem safer and better than using x-rays in general.
Well, that is a very good question. I would certainly love for more women to have access to screening breast MRIs because, as the doctor pointed out, it is really the best test that we have for identifying early breast cancer. There has been some research going on looking at shortening the MRI protocol. Currently, the protocol of our contrast-enhanced MRI to find cancers takes about 45 minutes to perform, and a lot of the cost is the magnet time, basically. It's expensive equipment. There are highly trained technologists working the equipment, and it's really the hospitals that charge the cost. And so if we could get that test to be shorter, I think we could get the cost down. And there was actually an article published just recently in the past few months in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. The study was performed in Germany, but by some very well-respected radiologists that I actually know in Germany. And they were able to get their screening MRI protocol down to, it was less than 10 minutes, I think. And they showed a very high sensitivity and specificity. So we've actually been talking about that at our institution, and I think we're going to see a lot more coming out, more studies that needs to be done here, you know, in America, and see what cost it would be, and hope that we can get the cost down.
We'll continue our conversation about breast cancer after the break, and we'll take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining this afternoon as we talk about the causes, treatments, and research on breast cancer are Dr. Amy Argus, a radiologist and assistant professor at the UC College of Medicine, Sarah Kanapke, clinical manager and licensed genetic counselor in the Division of Human Genetics at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Dr. Jamie Lewis, surgical oncologist and UC College of Medicine assistant professor. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Susan in Blue Ash. Good afternoon, Susan, and thanks for hanging on so long. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. I am one of six sisters, and my mother and my sister both have had breast cancer, and I have been having mammograms for the last 30 years every year, and I'm concerned about the amount of X-ray exposure increasing the risk. One of my sisters has stopped getting mammograms because she's concerned with the increased risk with exposure to the X-ray.
The X-ray with the mammograms, that we do think that it has a slight increase in the risk of breast cancer. It may cause a few breast cancers, but we diagnose many more cancers by doing the screening mammograms, and thus it has always been thought that the benefit of identifying a cancer early outweighs the very small risk of causing a few extra breast cancers by doing screening mammograms. And, you know, and particularly if you're at a higher risk because of your family history, that I think it would be important for you to continue mammograms so that you would give yourself the best chance at finding something early should it develop. You could also consider adding the screening MRI test, which, as we've said, is a very good test at finding breast cancer if your risk is high enough, which potentially you'd want to maybe talk with a genetic counselor such as Sarah here, or at least talk with your doctor about your risk and try to estimate your breast cancer risk to see if even more testing would be something you'd be interested in.
Thank you very much for the call, Susan. We appreciate it. Kathy emailed and says she had her first mammogram in December and just turned 40, and she's now 8 weeks pregnant. So she was wondering if she can have a mammogram during pregnancy.
We recommend not to have a mammogram during pregnancy. The breast tissue is more sensitive to the radiation. We say that it's more radiosensitive. It's because of the proliferation of the glandular tissue in the breast that we do want to limit any radiation to the breast during pregnancy. So we suggest actually waiting at least 3 months after you finish nursing, if you decide to nurse or breastfeed before having another mammogram. That being said, if there's a suspicion that something is wrong, you know, if there's a mass or something, we will do we can do mammograms if needed, but if it's just for screening and no other problem going on, I would suggest waiting.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, let's talk with Victoria in Oxford. Good afternoon, Victoria. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hello. My question is regarding dense breast tissue, which shows white just like cancer does. And so then getting a sonogram or ultrasound, which I understand are the same thing, but I understand there may be a new sonogram machine, Sonosign or something like that, that perhaps is a better detection for someone with dense breast tissue.
Yeah.
They always call me back in. I get a double dose of radiation. I have to go under the pain again. I'm trying to avoid that.
You bring up a very good point about breast density. Yes, you are correct that the breast tissue, when it's dense, what we call dense, looks white on a mammogram. And that is actually the fibroglandular tissue of the breast that shows up white on the mammogram, whereas the fatty tissue within the breast shows up dark. So the more fibroglandular tissue, the more dense the breast looks on the mammogram. And the problem with that is that the dense white tissue can obscure a mass, which, you know, potentially a cancerous mass that looks white on the mammogram. So there has been a lot going on looking at breast density and how we can better screen women with dense breasts. And so there are a few options. Ultrasound is one option. Ultrasound screening can be added to a mammogram, which is where we do basically an ultrasound or a sonogram. They are the same thing. There's no radiation with that. It uses sound waves to image the breast. So we can do screening ultrasounds. There have been quite a few studies looking at that. The thing about screening ultrasounds is it does show a few additional cancers. Varying studies show an additional 2 to 4 cancers per 1,000 women screened would be found with ultrasound. But there's one downside to the ultrasound screening in that it causes a lot of what we call false positives. So ultrasound screening finds a lot of things in the breast that are not cancer and actually prompts a lot of benign biopsies. So studies that have looked at it, the amount of biopsies that are actually positive showing cancer has been anywhere from like 6 to 10%. So 90% of the biopsies don't show cancer. So it prompts a lot of biopsies for things that don't really need biopsies, more so than screening with mammograms. But it is an option for dense breasts, and we add that to a mammogram, usually do a mammogram and ultrasound, because some cancers show up on a mammogram and not an ultrasound, and some cancers show up on an ultrasound and not a mammogram, so we use both together. And then there's another newer option as well that we're using at UC, and that's called 3D mammography or tomosynthesis. And so that is just kind of a different way to do a mammogram, where rather than taking the flat two-dimensional picture of the breast like your traditional mammogram, this kind of sweeps across the breast and takes multiple little thin slice images of the breast, and it's sort of like paging through a book and looking at the breast in thin slices. And that is helpful with the dense breast tissue because it helps, it decreases some of that obscuration by the normal dense tissue that could be overlying a mass. And the thing about that is it also decreases the false positives. We're also finding less false positives using 3D mammography than we do with just traditional 2D mammography, and definitely less false positives when compared to ultrasound. It hasn't really been well studied yet as to what's the benefit, how many more cancers will we find if we add ultrasound to 3D mammography. There's probably going to be a few cancers that we would still find with ultrasound that we can't see on 3D mammography in very dense breast tissue, but the benefit of adding the ultrasound is not as great when added on top of a 3D mammogram. So I would suggest that you may want to look at having 3D mammograms for your screening rather than just the traditional 2D. And it is, as I said, we've put it in at UC Health across our health system, and I know many of the other health systems in town have also started using it. So it's a new technology, but I think it's going to be the new way that we all do mammograms pretty soon, and hopefully that will help you with all your callbacks and improve your sensitivity of your mammogram with your dense breast tissue.
Sarah, what about genetic testing for breast cancer? Where does all of that fit into this picture, and who should consider doing genetic testing?
Sure. So when you're thinking about your personal and family history, there are a number of what we call red flags that might make you a candidate for genetic evaluation and genetic testing. So certainly if there are early ages of diagnosis with breast or other cancers in the family, if there's the combination of breast and ovarian or other cancers in the family, if you see generation to generation having impact from breast or other cancers, if you see male breast cancer in the family, which is a more rare situation, then that might clue us into a certain, you know, genetic risk. You know, definitely, I think just being knowledgeable about your personal and family history are a step in the process of understanding your risk. So taking that information to your healthcare provider and then certainly talking with a genetic specialist about what testing might be appropriate. So as we've mentioned previously over this hour, certainly I think a lot of people are familiar with the BRCA1 and 2 genes. You know, if you weren't familiar with them, then many people became familiar with them when Angelina Jolie told her story. We are now able to also offer testing for a myriad of other genes. So a lot of other genes that can increase risk for breast and other cancers. So if BRCA1 and 2 testing wasn't informative in a family previously, or if someone's newly diagnosed and exploring the genetic testing process, we might not just be offering or discussing testing for those particular genes, but anywhere from 6 to 20 to even more genes that can impact breast cancer risk. That makes the process more complex. We're more likely to get difficult to interpret results back. We're more likely to get genetic changes in genes that we don't know quite as much about, but it can still be very valuable and very powerful information for families.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's talk to Susan in Oxford. Good afternoon, Susan. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Good afternoon. First off, thank you for taking my call, and also thank you for having this program. I've enjoyed listening to it. I think the details are very rich and valuable for all of us to know about. So kudos to all of you for what you're doing.
Well, we appreciate the nice compliment. Thank you, Susan.
Sure, sure. I don't really have a question. I have a comment. And it's about actually my own story. I kind of chuckled when I heard one of your guests say that the average age is 61 for diagnosis, because that's when my breast cancer was diagnosed last fall when I was 61. So I fell right in there in the average age. The thing that is good, if you can say that, about my story is that I'm doing very well, and it was definitely a case of early detection for me. I was stage 2A and got excellent treatment and excellent follow-up, so I'm doing well. But the part of the story I really wanted to be able to share is that, for me, I always somehow thought that and inaccurately, obviously, that breast cancer was about finding a lump. And actually, in my case, it was more of a kind of thickening of my breast tissue. And actually, the way that I found it is I looked in the mirror, and I could see that there had been a change in my skin. It didn't look like it always did. And I kept staring and staring, and then had a family member look with me, and we both agreed there's some kind of change. I followed that up, and even though my diagnostic mammogram came through clear and the ultrasound that I had, I continued on because I had the doctor saying, you know, even though we have these results from you, you have a change in your skin tissue, I think you should continue on and see a breast surgeon. I did that. And I'm alive to tell the tale today. So I guess my story here is one of really encouraging women to really understand that we know our bodies, and we know what we look for and what we look like, and we just need to follow that intuition.
Susan, you listened to what your body was telling you, and that was wise in this case. Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join in. Let's talk to Gene in Mason. Good afternoon, Gene. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a combination question. Are there inhibitions in terms of deodorant, antiperspirant with the aluminum? What about chocolate? I believe you mentioned alcohol and exercise. Are these things that can create problems? And then also, finally, aggressive cancers, are there different types? Or, you know, what do you look for when you say an aggressive versus a non-aggressive?
So I'll try to hit on a few of those topics. Deodorant. So deodorant was a big topic for concern in the past that, for the most part, has been disqualified as a risk factor for breast cancer. It is applied to the underarm area. The majority of the breast tissue is in the upper outer quadrant of the breast. So we think it was the fact that the proximity of a fair number of cancers to the underarm area brought up that concern. We no longer suggest that women avoid certain types of deodorant. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. Chocolate, I don't know about. I'll have to look into that one. I'm not aware.
I hope that's not the case.
Well, I think chocolate and caffeine can aggravate fibrocystic disease in some women, meaning the symptoms of soreness or tenderness in the breast, but I don't believe, as far as I've heard, any increased risk of cancer.
And then alcohol. So there definitely is an associated increased risk with alcohol. Alcohol affects how the liver metabolizes estrogens, which are the strong female hormones, and those are definitely associated with breast cancer risk. So we typically say somewhere between 3 to 5 drinks. Alcoholic drinks per week is probably safe. Somewhere above that may increase the risk for breast cancer. And then the different types of aggressive cancers. There are definitely different types of cancers, especially the ones that are called triple negative or HER2 positive, which are subtypes of the invasive cancers that Dr. Argus was talking about. So depending on some of the receptors that we see on tumors, we can sometimes classify particular tumors as being more aggressive and needing more aggressive types of treatment.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Much appreciated. Dr. Amy Argus is a radiologist and assistant professor at the UC College of Medicine. Sarah Kanapke, clinical manager and licensed genetic counselor in the Division of Human Genetics at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And Dr. Jamie Lewis, surgical oncologist and UC College of Medicine assistant professor. There is a free symposium for anyone interested in learning more about advances in early breast cancer research. That's going to be on November 1st at the Kingsgate Marriott Hotel. The symposium, UC Cancer Institute Breast Cancer Journey Snapshot of Research, is free, but registration is required. And you can find more details on our website, wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our program at wvxu.org. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The technical director is Rick Andrus. I'm Mark Haney.